Well, hi everybody, and welcome to my goodness, 20th programme, my 20th podcast. It's all rather enjoyable, except for the fact that the number of people listening to it doesn't seem to be going up. Since I know quite a lot about my music, but very little about computer technology and the internet, it's really all up to you. If you are listening to this and enjoying it, please just send an email with a link to this site. As you know, it's free, so you're not doing any harm to anybody. And if you know anybody who will enjoy this music, please spread the word. I want to make it global, viral, whatever the word is. Well, today we're going to treat as the theme nurture versus nature. And I'm going to turn that into the great opera singer of the 19th century, Nellie Melba. Now, she was very much somebody who was self-made. She was born in Melbourne in 1861. She came of Scottish stock. Her real name was Helen Mitchell, and Melba was simply a sort of an Italianate version of her hometown Melbourne. I've actually been to the house where she lived, actually, just outside Melbourne. And until she was in her early 20s, she had no idea of being a singer at all. She was married at a very early age to somebody called Captain Charles Porter Armstrong, very posh, but she obviously had no time for him because she separated from him at the age of only 22, so she must have been very young when she married, and she must already have had a will like iron, because that's what she was going to need. She didn't even think about becoming a singer until she separated from her husband, and she took part in a performance of Handel's Messiah, which she must have enjoyed, and as a result of that decided that she wanted to sing for a living and went to Europe for some further training. She gave a concert in London, which took a bit of what you might call chutzpah, and then she went to Paris to study with no less than Matilda Marchesi, the great teacher of the time, who must have seen in the young, what was to be, Nellie Melba, somebody with that tremendous willpower and drive to get herself as good as she could be. And that must have appealed to Marchesi, because she was quite a strict teacher. Nellie Melba had a good, basic, sort of English-sounding voice, you might say. Pure, almost like a choir boy. And she had to simply learn and learn and learn and learn the techniques of singing coloratura passages which she would need to sing an opera. In my opinion, she never was a great coloratura soprano, but there's a purity in her voice. They always described it, at the time, as silvery, never gold, always silver. It's got that pure, young, as I say, almost choir boy sound to it. She's always dead in tune. Her musicality is perfect, but not sort of exciting. Nevertheless, she turned herself into a great soprano. And in the 19th century, to be famous and successful, you had to be good, because the competition was something fierce. A lot of great singers around. So we must always accept that she must have been a great singer even then, even under those standards of the day, which were higher than certainly they are now. The reason I'm saying all this is because listening to her recordings, and I think she's very badly treated by the acoustic recording method, you have this slightly hooty sound and you don't get the full impression of how beautiful her voice must have sounded. Indeed, only when she was 65 and made her very last live recordings do you get her and get some idea of the size of her voice, which was probably bigger than we realised. After all, she did have to fill theatres without a microphone. And you get something more of the warmth which must have been there, which again isn't really picked up by the horn. Nevertheless, she did make some beautiful recordings, and I'm going to give you one of her in Otello, one of her key roles, Desdemona from Otello, the other one being Mimi in La Bohème. She was really a lyric soprano of the highest quality, rather than a coloratura soprano, or certainly not a dramatic one. So this is her in one of her key arias, and she, by this time, reigned at Covent Garden. She'd got herself very, very well connected with the top society, and nobody was allowed to rival her at Covent Garden. It was as if, I'm the queen here, don't even think about invading my territory. She wasn't the nicest of people. She sorted out a deal where nobody could be paid as much as she was. She was that sort of driven person, and I suppose that's why she became successful and stayed successful till the very last days of her life, when she decided finally to retire. As I say, not the most pleasant of people, selfish and driven, but there's no doubt that she was the name of the age. So here she is in Otello, and it's a fine, fine record, made around 1909, 1910. Nelly Melba singing Ave Maria from Othello, where Desdemona prays before the scene where she's murdered by her husband. Wonderful writing. And fine singing. Notice not a trace of vibrato, a really English voice which appealed to all the Anglo-Saxon audiences of the USA and the UK in particular, not to mention Australia, of course. She had her friends and people who just adored her, so she wasn't an evil person. It's just that she had to be in control. Later on in life, she even ran opera companies and had protégés. Of course, these protégés had to be very good, but never good enough to have any chance at all of ever rivaling her supremacy. That's the sort of person she was, I think. She died, by the way, in 1931 after spending about 3 years doing farewell tours. Her very, very last performance was within a year of her dying, a sort of charity concert somewhere. Well, now for something, as they say, completely different. And if she sounded a little bit hooty because of the limitations of the recording technology of her day, then what you're about to hear sounds more like some sort of air raid siren. I loved this record when I was a little boy. Jerry Colonna was a reasonably well-known American comedian of the 30s and 40s. You see him in the odd Hollywood film. He obviously was of Italian abstraction. And he sported a wonderful Italianate moustache. Not one of the superstars, but he had this ability to sing. He probably could have sung very well had he decided to use his voice to sing properly, but he used his tenor voice to produce this banshee-like note that would come in and take your brains out and use it for comedic purposes. This was one of his most successful records in the early 50s, and it's called Ebb Tide, and he does something very strange with it, as you'll hear. As a little boy, I loved this record, and even did impressions of it in my little young 4 or 5-year-old voice. So this is Jerry Colonna singing Ebb Tide. Come back! Jerry Colonna. When he came on tour to Great Britain, he played at a theatre which doesn't exist anymore called the Finsbury Park Empire, and I was taken along there by my parents, and I got to go backstage afterwards and meet him. I think he was rather bemused by somebody who was 4 or 5 years old, already a big Jerry Colonna fan. But I got my autograph somewhere around the house. I still have it, I'm sure. Well, if you go around London now, you'll find a lot of white teenagers who are trying their best to be black. They adopt the accent and all sorts of things because it's cool. And in a strange way, it always was so. While you had black artists who wanted to be taken as somewhat white to give them more dignity in those racialist times, you had, on the other hand, white artists who were attracted by black culture, and I'm talking about the USA now, and in order to do so for a long time, they used burnt cork and performed in blackface. Quite often this was done in a demeaning way, but sometimes not. And one example of the latter was somebody called Tess Gardella. Again, one assumes she came from an Italian family. But she appeared on stage always as Aunt Jemima in blackface, and as such she appeared in the early Broadway production of Showboat. And thus, this is pretty much a creator's version of this famous song from that musical way back in the late 20s. So, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a very good performance too, I give you Aunt Jemima, or Tess Gardella if you prefer, singing Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine. Tess Gardella, who not only sounds like a black singer, but her makeup is wonderful. There's a picture which I've put up, which is her in blackface. And this was no taking the mickey out of black people thing. This was a real attempt to fool everybody. And she really does look like a black performer. And she's good enough to be one, because you had to be better than everybody if you were going to be black and a performer back in those days. She's pretty good, actually. She was born in 1894, died in 1950, and I don't know what happened to her after the 30s. She made an appearance in one or two little films, a couple of shorts and so forth, and then she seems to have faded out of the limelight after the mid-30s. She died in 1950, as I say. Tess Gardella. Surprisingly impressive, I think. Well, not at all surprisingly is the following artist. I don't know how it is I haven't mentioned him already, but I don't seem to have done. Born in 1910 in Toledo, Ohio. Died in Los Angeles in 1956. A short life, but he changed the world in that time. We all know about the great jazz pianist James B. Johnson, Fats Waller, and so forth. Earl Hines, whom I'll also play a track at some point. But this young man who was overweight, had very little eyesight, and slopped about in an ill-fitting t-shirt and jeans or whatever, he would then sit down at the keyboard and blow everybody away. On one occasion, he actually had the temerity to follow Earl Hines onto the piano stool, and somebody actually came up to him and said, "Kid, do you know what you're doing? You're following Earl Hines." And he said yes, he knew, and then he sat down and blew everybody away. Well, some of you will know already that I'm talking about Art Tatum. Even today, even the most modern of pianists will bow down to Art Tatum. Nobody's ever matched what he did. Oscar Peterson, that doyen of jazz piano, he was his hero. He knew that he could never play the way Art Tatum did. There are people who try and imitate him, and they manage to learn one of his solos note for note, and they can do it. But Art could sit down and play for half an hour without repeating himself. He was sort of a genius. One of the greats of jazz. Certainly the great jazz pianist. And I'm going to give you his most famous recording, which is his version of T for Two. This came out in a session that he did in the early 30s when he was just over 20 years old. He did four numbers in the session. This one was the one that everybody remembers, and once the other pianists had heard it, they all decided to retire early, or they had to deal with it in some way. This is, ladies and gentlemen, Art Tatum. And remember, there is only one person playing. It sounds like there's about three of them, but no, just one man, and that man had to be Art Tatum. Thank you. Tatum, one of the greats in jazz, the gold standard of jazz piano, you might say. Well, he died in 1956, and I was only 9 at that time, so I have no direct experience of Art Tatum, but I do have a couple of connections with him. As you may know, I was friends for a long time with the great Adelaide Hall, and believe it or not, Art Tatum's first big-time gig was being one of the two pianists with whom she toured. She had always two pianists accompanying her in the USA when she first got famous, and he fulfilled that job for a while. And I asked her once if he didn't play too many notes, and she said no, he just kept, he did what was required. He was a fine accompanist, very young then, of course. He would have been in his early 20s. The other person who often played behind her was Joe Turner, not the blues singer, but Joe Turner, the last of the great stride pianists. And he was responsible partly for taking Tatum to New York. And there's a legend that James B. Johnson, who was the ruling stride pianist until then, never forgave him because he took his throne. Many years later, Joe Turner moved to France and for years and years played every night at a place called La Calvados in Paris, where I saw him and met him. He just played there and people would buy him drinks, and he was happy, he could play all evening, and he liked living in France. By the way, you might try and get hold of a wonderful live concert in 1944, I think it was, New York Town Hall, which has Art Tatum, Al Casey, Fats Waller's usual guitarist, Sid Catlett, the great drummer, and Oscar Pettiford as the rhythm section. Oh, and some unknowns in the band, such as Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday. It's a great LP. The sound isn't too wonderful, but it's a wonderful concert. You might look out for that LP, or now it would be a CD. Look out for it if you can. Well, having dealt with Art Tatum, let's go back to the theme that I was talking about before, which was the battle between nature and nurture. I was talking about Nellie Melba and how she was a sort of self-made woman. She wasn't, for instance, even particularly good-looking, but she had the best gowns, and she made very sure that Nellie Melba always looked glamorous in her heyday, always in the best gowns. So there was also an aura of glamour, even though she wasn't really as pretty as she made herself out to be. She was madly in love with a great tenor called Jean de Reschke, who was the reigning tenor in the 90s. Nothing ever happened between them, but she was always potty about him, quite obviously, in her writings. He was the tenor. Everybody had to live up to Jean de Reschke. As I said before, she'd arranged it so that she was the reigning queen at Covent Garden. Well, there's a film made in the 30s called Evensong, and it's based on what happened next, because she was in Australia in 1907, when there was a sensational debut of a new soprano there. Well, not that new, but she was new to Covent Garden, apparently. And this was the great Luisa Tetrazzini. She was born a decade after Melba in Florence, in Italy, Firenze, and she first studied with her elder sister, Eva, who was supposed to be an even better singer than Luisa, but we'll never know because she never made records. Gosh, if she was better than Luisa, she must have been something. There was a younger sister too who also made records, but I'm afraid she wasn't up to the standard of the rest of the family. It took her a while to get recognition, and she finally managed to sort of make it in the smaller opera houses in Italy. As I've said before, there were so many great opera singers around, it was difficult to drag yourself to the top of the pyramid. But she really made it after she made a tour of South America in the late 90s, and then she guested in San Francisco, and she was in Russia at one point with a tenor that she had most in common with, which was, of course, Enrico Caruso. Now, these two were both very sunny, generous-spirited people, very different to Nellie Melba. And in the same way, she was a very different singer. She had an amazing voice. I didn't realize, because, as I say, these are acoustic records, until I read something written by Frieda Leider, a great Wagnerian soprano with a huge voice, who once said that she never heard anybody with as big a voice as Tetrazzini. And I'd always thought of Tetrazzini as a sort of coloratura soprano. And I went back to listen to the records, and indeed, with that knowledge, you listen through the sound and you begin to realize what a big voice it was. But it also was a voice that could sing as high as he wanted, and had a good bottom to the voice too, and he had a phenomenal ability to sing coloratura, all the florid passages. She flings herself into the music just as Art Tatum flings himself into playing a jazz solo. She adores all the technical challenges of what was written for sopranos in the 19th century. And comparing her with Melba, it's rather like comparing one of those very English tap dance teachers who does all the steps correctly and you're very impressed with it. And then you come across a black tap dancer who danced in the 30s like John Bublitt, who just does it naturally, and it's a whole different thing. Well, this was the competition that suddenly Melba was faced with in 1907, and she came rushing back to London to protect her patch. And the newspapers of the day were very aware of this sort of battle of the divas, and if I can find it, I'm going to put up together with this on my site a cartoon made at the time of these two sopranos apparently having a duel with gramophones. I also have here a program for Covent Garden where a visiting royal family was treated to excerpts from operas that very year, 1907, and I noticed that they could hardly get rid of Ted Rossini once she'd had the effect that she'd had. So you have Ted Rossini in an act of an opera and then Melba, both of them, on show so that you could choose for yourself. Well, I've talked a lot about Ted Rossini. By the way, she was a very generous person, wasn't at all the sort of control freak that Nellie Melba was, and she didn't worry about what she looked like. Later on, she got very fat, and one of her famous sayings was, "Other sopranos got the figure, Tetta Rossini got the voice," which was absolutely true. She had to carry on singing till she was in her 60s, and she ended her days not particularly well off, I understand. She died in 1940, almost 70 years old. And there's one little tantalizing bit of her singing on sound film in the mid-30s, at the end of her career. This, however, is going to be the highlight of her career. This is her singing an aria called Io son Titania, Je suis Titania, from a French opera, but nevertheless she is singing it in Italian. And here, the way she just deals with all the coloratura technicalities as if they're nothing more than a five-finger exercise, I've chosen the USA recording of it because it's with an orchestra, and it's slightly slower than the one made in England around the time of her debut here, but that's with a piano only, and I think they tried to do it too quickly, and even though she's fine, I prefer the slightly slower version. So that's what I'm giving you. This is from the opera Mignon, written by Ambroise Thomas, and this is Luisa Tetrazzini at her best, and her best was pretty good. 1911, Luisa Tetrazzini.
Thank you.
the great Luisa Tetrazzini. You know, there weren't actually that many famous sopranos at that time who were really fat. The fact that everybody seems to think that everybody was fat when they were soprano years ago was probably down to her fame, you know, when the fat lady sings and all that. Probably Luisa Tetrazzini, because I can't think of any other fat sopranos, really. But she was one of the greats. By the way, before I forget, a little story going back to Art Tatum. Apparently the great classical pianist Vladimir Horowitz was so impressed with this T4II that he sat down and wrote sort of 10 minutes of brilliant variations on T4II. Apparently contacted Art Tatum, and they got together, and he played his variations to Art Tatum. And Art Tatum was very impressed and said, oh yes, wonderful. And then Horowitz asked him what he would do when asked to do some variations on T4II, upon which Art Tatum sat down and played for half an hour without repeating himself, and Horowitz tore up his variations and just gave up. Different sort of talent. No doubt Tatum couldn't have played Beethoven and Chopin, but what he could play was amazing. Well, anyhow, let's finish. Let's give our top of the bill to a man who probably never topped a bill with a mixture of people I've just given you, but certainly was a top of the bill act. This was the great Lancashire comedian, Liverpool born, but using more of a straight Lancashire accent, Rob Wilton. Nellie Melba was born in 1861, Tetrazzini in 1871. Rob Wilton was born in 1881 and lived till 1957, and he was still doing little bits in films as late as 1955. The heyday of his career, however, was the late 20s and 30s and early 40s, when he put together these character sketches based on incompetent people who were supposed to be in authority, people like justices of the peace, firemen, policemen. Usually he was sitting at a desk with paper everywhere. God knows what the paper was supposed to have on it, because it went flying in all directions. Total incompetence. Very funny. But he also, since he couldn't sing, or apparently couldn't, did what a lot of people did on stage in variety shows, which was to sort of recite a poem which fitted the music being played by the accompanying orchestra. And it's, again, remembering of all the things that comedians weren't allowed to say in those days. Nothing that was too sexy or religious or, well, just about anything. It's amazing how funny this little poem still is. It's called I Should Say So, and it's a recording of Rob Wilton in 1931. Incidentally, make sure that you have a look at him on YouTube. He's just great. One of the greats of the variety stage, Rob Wilton.
I've got a pal, a real pal, who's been a pal to me. In time of grief and trouble, he's as happy as can be. Some time ago last winter, I had what they call the flu. And Jim, my pal of years gone by, came round to pull me through. He looked at me and sighed and said, it's all up, that is clear. And he looked at me again and said, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. He said, you don't half look bad, you don't. I said, who do? He said, you don't. I said, I do. He said, yes, you do, you don't. And he said, you won't live long, you won't. I said, who won't? He said, you won't. I said, I won't. He said, you won't. I said, why? I said, what makes you say so? He said, say so, I should say so. It's £1,000 to 1 you're going to die. Well, you might last out till Sunday, but you can't live over Monday. So I think I'd better go now. I said, aye. I bought a car the other day for £1, 2 and 3 to take the missus and the kids one fine day to the sea. Well, we've all been trying to start it, we've twisted and we've twirled. In less than half the time, we could have travelled round the world. So I advertised to sell it, and a fellow called today. You know, like to see the car. I said, oh, ah, well, here we are, and say. Now, that ain't half a car, that ain't. He said, which ain't? I said, that ain't. He said, that ain't. I said, yes, it is, it ain't. I said, but be careful when you try her. She's a flyer. If you buy her, you've a bargain. You can take the tip from me. He said, what makes you say so? I said, say so, I should say so. That's a real car. You'll have no cause for growls. He said, you don't seem to get me, so I'll tell you if you'll let me. I want it for a hen house for the fowls. I tried to separate two women who were fighting in the street. I got between them and said, girls, do try and be discreet. A policeman came. They both escaped. He said, come on with me. He said, you caused the row. I said, me? How? He said, come on, we'll see. So I went before the magistrate and he fined me 20 bob. I said, how much? He said, £1. I said, I'll have some job. I said, I can't pay it, Governor. He said, who can't? I said, I can't. He said, you can't. I said, yes, I can't. He said, oh, well, that alters my decision and you must go to prison and for 14 days you won't come out, you shan't. I said, what makes you say so? He said, say so, I should say so. He said, it took me years to start that little spree. One was my wife's mother. It was a dead cert on the other. Now all through you, she's back and lives with me.
Rob Wilton in 1931, and I know that he sang that song for quite a long time because there's a film of it. It's probably on YouTube. I haven't checked, but I bet it's there somewhere. But I have seen it, and he uses different words, which means he must have written different verses for it as he used the song over years, probably live at various variety theatres. So one of his more successful songs. Well, I've talked far too long. I just want now to say that if you've enjoyed the show once more, please look at your list of email friends and send them a link to this show. If they don't like it, they don't have to listen to it. But if they might like it and have never heard it, that's the way I'll build up my audience. Because it takes quite a lot of time to do these programs and I want to share it with as many people as possible. Added to which I haven't had any requests for quite a while, so please do write in spats47@ntlworld.com. Well, enough of my talking, as I said. This is one of the very first demos that was made of my songs by Dick James, the same person who had the Beatles under contract, and he used to make little demo sessions of my songs and see if anybody wanted to cover them. In this case, the person who later recorded it was Cilla Black, way back when she was a young pop star. However, this is the original version as arranged by Zach Lawrence, who was the in-house arranger, and I've just met him again after all these years. And with that, I say au revoir until next time, which will be my Christmas show. So until then, this is Earl Oaken signing off.
I just keep it out of the light.